And continuing again with the Taylor Report, and yes, it's a new year, 2022. And we probably ought to learn not to be too optimistic. We should be demanding when they say that something's going to happen that they tell us how and involve more people. And instead of bringing out people to explain, well, now we have a new twist in the story. I'm referring back to our first half of the show talking about the pandemic. And again, by the way, Phil Conlon is here. Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8. And Bishop Tutu has died. He was a big figure throughout the latter part of the 20th century. One of the strongest, most eloquent voices against apartheid. And the reason, well, we want to acknowledge that and to say that it deserves a lot of respect. But as many others, we've been wanting to remind people that he wasn't a one-issue person, and that in the latter part of his life, he spent a lot of time talking about the Palestinian cause, which got him into some hot water, by the way. But he was quite combative and stood by his views and insisted. He said South Africans need to stand with the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people had stood with them, South Africa. And we should say that it was hardly mentioned when Nelson Mandela passed that he too was a very strong voice for the Palestinian cause. This is all part and parcel of the struggle against colonialism. And in the developing countries, former colonial countries, there is a feeling of solidarity. And it is, by the way, considered absolutely normal and ordinary. But when it reaches Ottawa and Washington and London, it is not so welcome. But anyway, just to say, we should recognize him. By the way, he said something once regarding Rwanda, which I thought was very helpful. He visited Rwanda after the fighting and the massacres of population. And there were these sites where human remains had been treated, dusted with what, I don't know, to preserve them. And he was visiting some of those sites. And his being a Christian and an archbishop kicked in. And he said, these are people should be buried. They deserve a funeral. These are human, you know, you don't put them on display. He was against that. And that went by the boards rather quickly. I think somebody advised him not to say it again because he was, there again is an issue of political propaganda, which goes on. But I credit him. I thought, of course, he's absolutely right. Now on another issue, I want to, last week, Phil, we talked about the Ukraine, and a story slipped by that we didn't talk about, but I think it's emblematic of the kind of oddness of the crisis with Ukraine, which the CBC tells me, the CBS, and do they exist anymore? CNN, anyway, it's Fox, they all say we could have a war there. And we remarked on the fact that last week that the two best known political figures in Ukraine in recent years are calling each other the most amazing names. And Mr. Zelensky is calling Mr. Poroshenko, the chocolate king, is calling him a traitor, and said that he's actually collaborating with what they call pro-Russia elements in the East. I read the account. It was just an utter, what we call a cockamamie story, where you couldn't tell where it came from or who was saying what, and it seemed that And we, of course, made fun of the fact that Zelensky is, after all, a comedian by career. But this ain't funny. If you're going to tell us that there's going to be perhaps a war, and if your only headline every 3 days is Russians are massing troops, that in history has led to horrible circumstances. Phil, you probably know, but Adolf Hitler, you're not supposed to ever mention his name because everybody says, oh, golly, don't use Hitler. That doesn't make it. But Adolf Hitler claimed the Poles were massing troops on his border when he attacked Poland.
Yeah. And he even claimed when he attacked Poland that Poland had attacked him.
Oh, he did say it. Oh, yes. On the day that the offensive began, the attack, he said they were massing, and then they killed German border guards. And the next thing you know, well, anyway, this unspeakable stuff that goes on. And it's always good to remind folks that when you see a headline like that, you better take it with a grain of salt and also start looking into the matter. But the story that I wanted to make sure didn't go past us is that on page one of the Globe, and it would have been about 10 days ago, there was an interview done with the defense minister of Ukraine. And boy, was it remarkable. And it's incidentally, that story was published and has disappeared. But here's what he said. He said, we need Canada. We need the United States. We need the UK to get their troops here, to come in here, to stand with us. Then he used the line, the Anglo-Saxons have got to join this battle. The Anglo-Saxons. Hello, multicultural Canada. The defense minister of Ukraine seems to know something about your country that you don't know. And I don't know, is he mistaken? Five Eyes is a white, Christian, Protestant, English-speaking empire.
Yeah.
Five Eyes. And so maybe the defense minister is just a reasonable guy. But I loved the fact that he went further and he said, the Germans and the French are not trustworthy because they're practical. They want a practical arrangement with Russia. They're friendly to Russia. And so the Anglo-Saxons, I gather from the defense minister, are not practical. And they don't like Russians, if I follow him. Now this is, he comes and everybody has a picture taken, and then we send him weapons, and we send people that they say are training, which I already pointed out, Ukrainians don't need training. They've trained to the teeth. They've been skirmishing and killing each other now so they don't need it. But this is all showtime. But the fact that he laid the argument out so heavily, I think we should underline that. And I want to know, did the Canadian government correct him when he said Anglo-Saxon? Because when they're running for office, none of them are Anglo-Saxons anymore. There used to be some, but now everybody is, very much, well, oh yes, we're all the, multicultural, and we're all the peoples of Canada, blah, blah. But he doesn't think so. He says, no, you guys are Five Eyes. And we need you, by the way. We come over here because you hate Russians the way we do. And you say, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're back to World War I. That's how far he's taking us. Anyway, no response, nothing. I've read the Globe letters. Nobody in the Globe, nobody said, that's odd. No, and nobody in the Canadian government was asked, he called us Anglo-Saxon. Is that right? Don't you think you should caution him or just help him out a little? Anyway, you hadn't seen that story, Phil.
Oh, I did see this story. And of course, I immediately thought of Quebec. And I said, well, all right, does that mean you don't want units from the Canadian Army that are from Quebec and speak French when they come to save you against the Russians? Of course, then that's
suppose going back the people of Quebec heard that. I wonder.
That's right.
I have to say, since it's as far from Ontario as Albania, I don't know if the Quebec press commented on this. I would think they ought to, since
they certainly ought to. And of course, it doesn't.
Quebecer could say, "Hey, don't count on me because I'm not an Anglo-Saxon. You guys take care of yourself."
The issue here during what they call World War I, it was an issue because, of course, while the Anglo-Saxons in Ontario, which is how the people were told to think of themselves, were all very anxious to go over and get involved in the slaughter on behalf of the King of England, the people in Quebec had no such enthusiasm, and they had a great deal of difficulty getting them to join the Canadian Army, and because they would say in Quebec, very reasonably, why should I send my son to die for the King of England? Oh, I mean, I don't think anybody ever gave an answer that was of any.
That was very much the position, and that was true also. The Irish had a similar issue with Mr. Churchill. Apropos of that, I noticed that they had an event at Hong Kong to remember the Canadian soldiers served there at the beginning of World War II, and they said that they had school children read the poem, the famous Flanders Field by
John McCrae of Guelph, Ontario.
Yes, now we interviewed the author of a really great book. I'm sorry to say, I'm not gonna be able to tell you the title, but who talked about Canada in World War I.
And, it was a great book, it is a great book.
And we'll get back to you on that. Next week we'll talk more about it because it's a great book. But he pointed out, and this is, I left out the detail. They read the poem in French and English. Now, one little thing that was brought to the surface was that McCrae hated French Canadians because he considered them not patriotic. And I would say he's a rather typical figure of his time. So that poem, it would be translated without, he said in a letter to his, I think his brother, prime minister maybe, McCrae said, I wish I could be in Montreal and put a bayonet into those slackers. So I wouldn't think that'd be a terribly popular poem, knowing that, but that's just me. By the way, this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, it's 89.5 FM. And I did mention, that they had a memorial on December 9, 2021 for those Canadian soldiers who were killed and taken prisoners, those who died in prison, Japanese prisons, heroically and serving their country. And they really went through something though, because they were captured at the beginning of the war and they didn't get out until the war ended. And they lost, I think, half their number among the prisoners. It was pointed out in the story that those who ran the POW camps included several Japanese military officers. And remember, they were fascists. They were tried and hanged, several of them. And they are buried, the Japanese generals who were hanged are buried, Phil, in a famous cemetery. We've talked about it, the Yasukuni Shrine. You remember that?
Yes, and it's been in the news a number of occasions recently and causing a lot of controversy. Not that we would know about that from reading the Globe and Mail, but yes, it has been in the news recently.
Matter. So now Canada, so here they mentioned that these Canadian soldiers died there and in the hands of people convicted of war crimes. And the burial site, the Yasukuni Shrine, is shunned by those who supported the war effort that led to the building of the United Nations and the crushing of fascism, Nazism, the Japanese imperialism. And they say this, and it's somehow supposed it should be something we are conscious of. But I want to tell them that the Assiniboine shrine, which is shunned by most political figures around the world, and even in Japan, it is largely shunned. They had a visitor, Rabia Kadir, May 14, 2012. And she is probably the best known Uyghur leader. And so why would she go to the Assiniboine shrine? Simple answer. She was invited by very right-wing revanchist Japanese politicians. A couple of months ago, by the way, there was an incident. As many as 100 members of the Japanese parliament went to the Assiniboine shrine. That should concern us, particularly those who want to honor the memory of the Canadians who were tortured in Hong Kong after being taken prisoner, the ones who survived to be taken prisoner and then mistreated. I have a simple formula for an organization that has a leader who visited the Assiniboine shrine. You can keep on going down the street. Don't come anywhere near me. It is ridiculous. It is an embarrassment that an organization claims to be interested in democracy and self-determination and has a leader that went to visit the right-wing Japanese. And when I say right-wing, I don't mean the guys you read about who are, you know, Mr. Abe, although Abe himself is a very bad element. But that invitation that was accepted and the speeches given while she was there indicate that she is completely sympathetic to the Japanese attack on China. That's important. That's politics. That's important. People should have standards. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. And something has happened in Latakia, Syria, which should get our attention and should be spoken of. The Syrian crisis is far, far, far from over. Syria has managed to defeat the terrorist organizations sponsored by the US, UK, France, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, with the assistance of Turkey. Syria managed rallying its people and turning to its allies, which it had every right to do, to defeat the terrorist elements largely. However, we have a situation where the United States and Israel can't keep their hands off this. The United States landed troops in northeast Syria, and they have they've taken over oil fields, Syrian oil fields, completely illegally. They've entered the country completely illegally. And all kinds of cowards and opportunists here say, well, they're fighting terrorists. Even Noam Chomsky, I think, said that. That's just a camouflage and a lie. The U.S. Has no right to be in Syria, was not invited. Syria is a member of the United Nations, is a sovereign country. And now Israel, in recent days, has begun to attack a port. Ports are really important. And this is Latakia. What it will mean is we'll just have to see it unfold. But when you see active presence, putting firing missiles into Syrian city, this is going to be a difficult period to get through because Israel has connections to the other group, the last remaining terrorist center, Idlib. And they seem to be determined to rescue them or secure for them territory. The US is still using economic subterfuge, stealing oil from Syria. So this is a very dangerous situation. And you could speculate that perhaps they're hoping to draw Syria into a counterattack. You know, by the way, Phil, you would know, this isn't, you can't fire, warplanes cannot fire into a city of another state without that state having the right to retaliate, even you could say almost a duty. We all understand why they so far have not, but you could speculate that Israel is hoping to make themselves a party to the war. And again, that's going to cause the countries of what is, some say Mideast, some say West Asia, but governments will fall over that kind of thing. There will be a reshuffling. There's already a near reshuffling because of Yemen, where the Saudis have been waging on, I don't know how many years now, 10? Basically a bombardment of Yemen because the people of Yemen didn't want a Saudi leader. The Saudis appointed the Yemen leader and the people overthrew him. And Yemen is the poorest country in that region, the poorest, and they're fighting the richest, and they're doing quite well. So the Saudis may not be around much longer if they keep this up, because I can't remember in modern history a time when the Saudis got so deeply invested and took so many blows as they're taking now. So it's rather significant, I think. This is the Taylor Report, and I want to mention, Phil, I don't know if you must have seen the movie Quiet American, the one with Michael Caine.
That's a little bit a while back, but yes.
You did see it, Michael Caine's, because there, you know, there were two. There was a Marlon Brando Quiet American, and then there was a Michael Caine. Okay, you don't recall.
I'm trying to remember which one came first. No, I'm not sure.
This is kind of important in my view. I really urge people, this is a time to read a kind of a history book. I would urge people, our listeners, to get the novel Quiet American by Graham Greene, which was later turned into this film, and an excellent film it is. But read the book about how the leaders of the Western empires get themselves into bloody debacles. The U.S. now thinks Vietnam was its own story. You know, it happened, it had to do with the Americans. But the Quiet American is written when France was trying to hold on to North Vietnam. And the U.S. was coming there as quietly, that's the quiet part, pretending to be civilians and whatnot, but actually a ton of CIA people were moving in because they anticipated the French were going to be defeated at Dien Bien Phu. And when they were defeated, they knew that the pressure would be on their political friends and servants in South Vietnam. And they wanted, and they intended to hold on to South Vietnam to deny the right of the Vietnamese people to self-determination. Graham Greene was there at the time and describes it, how it unfolds. And for people to talk about regime change and sponsoring terrorism, it's all there. It's in that book. And if you had read, and you could start now, The Quiet American, you would be able to get the profile of American imperialism and how it operates. And so I was looking at it again. I've been rereading some Graham Greene. I read his autobiography, memoir, The Ways of Escape. And he visited Dien Bien Phu. And he said, and it's a wonderful kind of a metaphor for how the imperialists get in trouble. The French had Saigon. No, they did. Well, pardon me. Of course, they had Saigon. Pardon me for suddenly not remembering the city in the north.
Well, they had Hanoi. They didn't have Hanoi, right?
The French did have the north. Right. I'm talking about the French. Yeah. At any rate, the capital in the north. And the French military were looking at their situation, and the surrounding countryside was completely alien to them, and they couldn't control it. So they were deciding what to do. And some brilliant general, French general, said, well, you see, we're not on the offensive. We have to go on the offensive. So he said, pick out a plateau, that'd be Dien Bien Phu, and then parachute our best guys in there, secure it, build an airfield, and then tell the Viet Minh and Ho Chi Minh and General Giap, say to them, now, look, we're in your territory, you see? And Dien Bien Phu is going to be our little stronghold. And which led to a great comment from General Giap. Now, I don't know if he said it at the time, but the assumption was that the Viet Minh would not be capable of bringing artillery of the caliber that'd be able to reach the airfield. The assumption was that they were going to be, you know, cobbled together weapons, and they wouldn't be able to do any harm, or much harm. But General Giap said, well, I noticed that you have parachuted in a very substantial group of fighters. Can you parachute them out? And it turned out they couldn't. It was very striking. The French had a mental kind of meltdown when this occurred. But it was a case of, you know, people's war. Or yes, capable of bringing that artillery and winning that battle. And while all credit goes to all the Vietnamese people and their leadership for succeeding against Western imperialism, you need to go back and remind them it wasn't just Lyndon Johnson, it was the French, and the place was Dien Bien Phu. And if you read that, you will get a very good education. So I really urge you, read The Quiet American. You can watch Mr. Khan, Kane, pardon me, another actor, Khan, Kane, Michael Kane. One of the reasons to watch it is that Michael Caine knew Graham Greene well and actually had his accent down. And one of the characters, he turns the character, the English journalist, into Graham Greene for the public to see. Anyway, I highly recommend it. This is the Taylor Report. We thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.